On a day not long after Troop D acquired Jimmy and Rosalind, Tony Shaindinks crossed his own personal Rubicon and lied to the press. Not that the representative of the Fourth Estate in this case was very impressive, just a weedy, red-headed boy of 20 or so, a summer intern at the Statler County American, who would be going back to Ohio State in another week or so. He had a way of listening to you with his mouth hung partway open that made him look, in Archie's words, like a stark, raving, natural-born fool. But he wasn't a fool, and he'd spent most of one golden September afternoon listening to Mr. Bradley Roach. Brad gave the young reporter quite an earful about the man with the Russian accent. By this time, Brad was positive the guy had been Russian, and the car the man had left behind. The weedy redhead, Homer Usler by name, wanted to do a feature story on all of this and go back to college with a bang. Sandy thought the young man could imagine a front-page headline with the words, "Mystery Car," in it. Perhaps even, "Russian Spies, Mystery Car." Tony never hesitated, just went ahead and lied. He undoubtedly would have done the same thing even if the reporter presenting himself that day had been case-hardened old Trevor Ronick, who owned the County American, and had forgotten more stories than the redhead would ever write. "Car's gone," Tony said, and there it was. Lie told, Rubicon crossed. "Gone?" Homer Usler asked, clearly disappointed. He had a big old Minolta camera on his lap. "Property of County American," was dymo-taped across the back of the case. "Gone where?" "State Impound Bureau," Tony said, creating this impressive-sounding organization on the spot. "In Philly." "Why?" "They auction unclaimed rolling iron, after they search him for drugs, of course." "Course. Do you have any paperwork on it?"
"Must have," Tony said.
"Got it on everything else. I'll look for it, give you a ring."
"Well, how long you think that'll take, Sergeant Shaindinks?"
"A while, son." Tony waved his hand at his in-out basket, which was stacked high with papers. Usler didn't need to know that most of them were the week's junkalog from Scranton. Everything from updates on retirement benefits to the schedule for autumn softball. And would be in the wastebasket before the Sarge went home. That weary wave of the hand suggested that there were similar piles of paper everywhere. "Hard keeping up with all this stuff, you know. They say things will change when we start getting computerized, but that won't be this year."
"I go back to school next week."
Tony leaned forward in his chair and looked at Usler keenly. "And I hope you work hard," he said. "It's a tough world out there, son. But if you work hard, you can make it." A couple of days after Homer Usler's visit, the Buick fired up another of its light storms. This time it happened on a day that was filled with bright sun, but it was still pretty spectacular. And all Curtis's worries about missing the next manifestation proved groundless. The shed's temperature made it clear the Buick was building up to something again, dropping from the mid-70s to the upper 50s over a course of 5 days. Everyone became anxious to take a turn out in the hutch. Everyone wanted to be the one on duty when it happened, whatever it turned out to be this time. Brian Cole won the lottery, but all the troopers at the barracks shared the experience at least to some extent. Brian went into Shed B at around 2 p.m. to check on Jimmy and Rosalind. They were fine as paint. Rosalind in the Habitat's dining room, and Jimmy busting heavies on the exercise wheel in the gym. But as Brian leaned farther into the Buick to check the water reservoir, he heard a humming noise. It was deep and steady, the kind of sound that vibrates your eyes in their sockets and rattles your fillings. Below it, or entwined with it, was something a lot more disturbing, a kind of scaly, wordless whispering. A purple glow, very dim, was spreading slowly across the dashboard and the steering wheel.